I like that sequence of hymns for us that are numerically challenged. It makes it easier for us to follow. David just reminded me that Steve Myers saying that Panama City Beach feast site had been spared from this latest storm that went through, and we're awfully thankful for that. It is always an issue, seemed like every year, every fall, that when the storms come through, the hurricanes come through, there's always the folks who live in that area and the feast sites in that area are always a challenge and an issue. So hopefully God will continue to protect those places for us as we go along. Got a question here. Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and you're unable to go back to sleep? I'm sure that some of you do that, or at times maybe that happens to you. And when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, it is so quiet. In our house, we have traffic along the highway there, and we hear the vehicles going by. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's not much going by, and so it's very, very quiet. But that can be, it's a little bit of an issue and a problem for some people, and for myself at times as well. But it also can be a good thing. It can be used as a productive time. I always think that if I can't sleep tonight, almost assuredly tomorrow night I will be able to sleep. So I don't worry about it too much. It might make for a little bit of a ragged day, but it's not that bad. But what it can be used for, if that happens to you, is thinking and meditating. And a lot of times meditating, Psalms 1, we won't go there, but Psalms, the first chapter, in verse 2, it talks a little bit about meditating and the man who meditates on God's law. And the margin says that he ponders by talking to himself. And that's probably a very sort of an apt description about meditation and what it really is. But I had that experience lately where I woke up and I couldn't really sleep. So and part of the reason was because I was thinking about a certain issue or topic, if you will, and I couldn't sleep, so I was thinking about that. I had read a story about courage. And it was an interesting story, which I'll read here in a minute, about courage. And I was pondering, talking to myself in a way, about, are we born courageous, or are we born cowardly and with cowardice, or does it happen some other way? Do we naturally have courage, or does it have to be developed in some way? Where does courage come from? And that's what I want to talk about today. Where does courage come from? The title of this message, I was going to call it The Courage of Our Convictions, but then I realized, I went back through some of my other presentations, and I realized that I had already done that. I didn't know if I should just call it Courage of Our Convictions Part 2, but I decided not to. So I'm calling it Cowards and Courage. Cowards and Courage. Let's consider this. Courage is one of those things that it's not necessarily planned for. A lot of times it just sort of comes up. It springs up, and all of a sudden we're confronted with something that takes courage, or we can run from it, and we could be cowards if we want to. I'm personally a little bit of a natural coward, so I'm always looking for ways to improve that. But let me read you this story. It was in I found it of all places in a farming magazine that I get. It's a quarterly farming magazine, and it's called Farming Magazine, and it's sort of more about natural farming or small-scale farming or whatever you will. It's done down in from Holmes County, actually, is where it comes from. And this particular article was in that magazine. It's by Darris Howard, who writes short stories. And I went on his website, and you could look it up if you wanted to under his name. It's Daris Howard. And on his website, he has books. But then I discovered what he does. He writes short articles in a magazine, and then at the end of the year, he takes those 52 short articles and makes them into a book. This particular one is titled Courage to Stand Up to Friends. It's only one page, so I'll read it and for your consideration. So when I stood up to my friends defending a new girl at my school, the janitor, Mr. Bandon, saw the whole thing. He told me that it can take more courage to stand up to friends than to enemies. And you've probably maybe experienced that in your life. That was when he showed me a picture in his office of men from his World War II battalion and shared the story of Private Johnson, the man he said he most admired. Their battalion had fought across Europe, incurring heavy losses in the Battle of the Bulge. As the Germans ran out of supplies and started to retreat, the Americans set up a base camp. The supply trucks hadn't come as of yet, and what food they had was moldy and stale. They threw away the worst and ate what they could, because in those days, obviously, for any World War II vets, I'm sure they know this, they had to sometimes do with what they have and make do with what they have. Continuing on with the story, most of the local Germans were starving, having what little food they owned taken from them for the army. That night, some of them snuck into the camp to take the rotten food that had been thrown away, but they were captured. Now, these are the enemy, the Germans, that had been captured, but civilians. The next day, the colonel, who was in command, still angry at the losses his battalion had suffered, ordered the Germans to be shot. Mr. Bandon and Private Johnson were among those chosen for the firing squad. The Germans were brought out. They had suffered great deprivation, and most of them were so thin that their flesh hung loosely over their bodies. They were all just boys and old men because the fighting age men had been taken for war. The Germans were lined up, frightened and begging for their lives, but the colonel felt little mercy. He gave the orders. Ready? Aim. That was when Private Johnson lowered his rifle and spoke. He said, "Sir, I can't shoot them." The colonel was furious at this insubordination. He had Private Johnson step forward. "You will do as you are told," the colonel ordered. Private Johnson shook his head. "I can't. It isn't right. They are starving and just trying to find food for their families. They took nothing except what we threw away." The colonel stood there seething in anger. When he finally spoke, he nearly spit out his words. "They are the enemy. If you can't do your job, then you can take their place. You have a choice. Either do as you are commanded or release them and be shot yourself. Now get back in line." But Private Johnson didn't get back in line. He walked to the Germans while everyone stared after him. He pulled his knife and the German prisoners trembled, but he didn't hurt them. Instead, he cut the ropes that held them. He then motioned for them to go. They stood for a moment until he motioned to them again. Then they ran off as fast as they could. Then he did something no one there would ever forget. He stepped to the wall where the Germans had stood, bowed his head in prayer for a moment, and then looked up and said, "I'm ready." He closed his eyes and waited. The colonel had not expected this, excuse me, and his subdued voice quivered with emotion. "Ready?" Some of the men raised their guns to the ready, but most refused, Mr. Bandon being one of them. "Aim," came the next command. Private Johnson closed his eyes to wait. He started to tremble from fear, but ready to die rather than kill innocent people. Mr. Bandon closed his eyes, unable to watch. But no order came. When Mr. Bandon finally opened his eyes, the colonel had stepped in front of the guns. He had an expression on his face that showed the emotion he felt at the display of courage Private Johnson had shown. The colonel motioned for the men to lower their rifles, and then he turned to Private Johnson. Johnson, the colonel bellowed, you have a new assignment. Sir, Private Johnson questioned, you choose yourself a few men to help you and make sure that any food we're disposing of is distributed to anyone who can use it. That is an order. Do you understand? Private Johnson smiled. Yes, sir. Mr. Bannon joined Private Johnson in this endeavor, and they became good friends. So you see, Mr. Bannon told me, it can take even more courage to stand up to friends than it does to enemies. And I'm sure that we can relate to that, that sometimes it's harder to confront or stand up for what's right to those we know, those we are close to, than for those we don't know or those who we would perceive to be not our friends, maybe the enemy and so forth. There are lots of stories everywhere about those who are heroes and have great courage, whether it's in wars, whether it's in as they've been captured in some regard and so forth. And I know that we hear stories of great courage quite often, every now and then, and we could probably recite some as well. The Bible is also full of stories of great courage, and we are going to review a couple of them today. We could have picked Ruth or Esther or Job from the Old Testament. If you look at Job, took a tremendous amount of courage for what he did. When he lost everything, he said, "The Lord gives, the Lord taketh away. Great is the name of the Lord." And I don't know if I would have had, in the face of what he faced, that if that would have been my response and my reaction. Maybe it should be, but I'm not sure if I could have done that like Job did. In the New Testament, we could think of John the Baptist, who was in prison and he was beheaded. We could think of Peter, because Peter, we know that at one time, Peter was sort of a coward. While he claimed he was going to stand up for Jesus Christ, he ended up fleeing. He ended up not standing up for him at that critical moment. But later on, and not too far in the future, he did stand up and he was counted in prison. He said, "Should we obey God or should we obey men? You," and he told those who were accusing them, "you make the choice. You think about it." And also Stephen, who was the first martyr in the church, who gave his life right away, pretty soon after the resurrection and the New Testament church started. We could have picked him or anybody from Hebrews 11. There were many courageous men and women that are listed in Hebrews the 11th chapter, the chapter of faith. We're not going to choose any of these, but we're going to talk about a spy and a prisoner of war, a POW, instead. There, in the Old Testament, and we're only going to talk about one of these, but there are two heroes I've often thought that and felt like that they were overshadowed by who they replaced. One of them was Elisha, and we probably know about Elisha, but we know much more about the man, the prophet that he replaced, who was Elijah, because Elijah is the one we hear mostly about. Elijah, after all, called fire down from heaven and so forth, and it consumed the altar and the fire around the altar that he had made, as well as what was on the altar, and he had asked for a rain, no rain for 3.5 years, and that happened. So he is much more popular, but Elijah did a great work on his own. But he is a little bit overshadowed by the one he replaced, by Elijah. The other one was Moses' protege, Moses' assistant. And we don't hear as much about him maybe as we even should, or we're not prone to think about him as much as we do about Moses. And Moses, of course, it says that there was no greater prophet ever than Moses. And this is true. But Joshua, who was his assistant, it says his minister in one place, but it means his servant, was also a great man. And we're going to look at him for just a little bit. The first time he shows up, and I'm not sure that this is necessarily chronologically the first time, but it is as far as the books of the Bible are concerned. And that is in Exodus, the 12th, or the 17th chapter. Exodus 17. And he's just abruptly introduced onto the scene. There's not anything much said about him, or there's no introduction to him in any way or form. It says in verse 8 of Exodus 17, it says, "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim." Now, they were, as they were traveling, they had a few skirmishes along the way in the wilderness, and this was in the wilderness. So in verse 9 it says, "And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek." In verse 13 it says, "Joshua defeated Amalek." And that's really about all there is that was said about Joshua as his introduction in the Word of God. Doesn't give a lot of detail and background. But as we go along, we can find out a few more things. In Exodus 24, we found out a little bit more about Joshua. Exodus 24. Excuse me. And we'll, first of all, here, this will give you a little background of the setting here. Moses, they were at the foot of Mount Sinai. Exodus 24, we're going to read a couple of verses here. They were at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they had some of the elders there and so forth. And in verse 12, it said, "The Lord said to Moses," this was Moses and some of the other people, the elders of Israel, "Come up to me on the mountain and be there. I will give you tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written, that you may teach them." So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. Now, to some extent, you could think that maybe Joshua went all the way up with Moses, but I don't think that was necessarily the case. He might have gone part of the way up the mountain with Moses, but I don't think he was there when God and Moses were face to face. I don't believe that's the case at all. But he was in the vicinity, and he was an assistant, and he was there with Moses at Mount Sinai, along with some other people as well. But it just gives us the indication that he was an assistant of Moses, that he was important to Moses. One of the things, and maybe the most famous thing that we think about when we think about Joshua, is the fact, and I said we're going to talk about a spy and a POW, and here's the spy. He was a spy. In Numbers, the 13th chapter, we find that. Numbers 13. Here we go, Numbers, the 13th chapter, and in verse 1, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, every one a leader among you.'" Now, there was one person from all 12 tribes, except for there was nobody from the tribe of Levi, but there was one person from both Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, because the Levites were excluded from these types of things because it was their job to take care of the religious things. They didn't get an inheritance in the land of Canaan specifically, and they were not numbered among the children of Israel when it came to fighting and so on and so forth. And so here, they weren't listed either. But in verse 8, it says, "From the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun." Now, that doesn't say Joseph or Joshua here, but it is Joshua, because in verse 16 of the same chapter, verse 16, chapter 13, says, "These are the names of the men," and it's completed, finished with the list. "These are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land," or to secretly search out the land. "And Moses called Hosea, the son of Nun, Joshua." Now, Hosea meant salvation. And when he changed his name to Joshua, that meant Jehovah is salvation. So it has a little different meaning, similar to Abraham, that where he changed his name from Abram to Abraham. He made a change in the name just. And names to God meant something. They were called after their characteristic, or after a certain event that happened at the time they were born, and so on and so forth. It was not like we do now, oftentimes, and we still may do that to some extent, to name them after relatives and so forth. But in those days, they took names of events, places, things that happened, so on and so forth, and they used those names to describe those people. So the other thing, Joshua, the name of Joshua has the same meaning as the name of Jesus. Both of them mean Jehovah is salvation. So he had the same name as Jesus Christ did. Not Christ, but the Jesus, the forename of Jesus. They went out spying, and in verse 25 it said they spied out the land, and Moses sent them out there to get the lay of the land, to see what it is. Is this a productive land, a fruitful land, a land that has fruits and vegetables and much grazing land and grass and trees and all those things that help, fertile soil, all those things that help make a land desirable, to help make land something that would be worth fighting for. And this particular land was. And it says in verse 25, they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. So they spied out the land for 40 days, and then they came back with a report. Now, when they came back with a report, the report starts in basically in verse 27. All these, now these are 12 men that had gone out, looked at the land, got a description of it. They had even brought back on a pole between two men, they had brought back a big cluster of grapes that took two men to carry them. So it was obvious that it was a productive land. And they told him, the spies, and said, "We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land," verse 28, "are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants." Cowards they were. They had forgotten what God had done for them, how he had protected them, how he had divided the Red Sea, how he had protected them from the Egyptians, how he had protected them from all the people in the lands from which they had come. They had forgotten that. "It's a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are of great stature. There we saw the giants." These were the Nephilim, the giants that had actually been spoken of, I think, in Genesis. And it's a term that was meant to frighten the people, a term that was meant to cause them anxiety and cause them to not want to go into this land is why they use this. There we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight. So we were in their sight. We were just little insects compared to them. And that's what we thought, and that's what they thought. I think maybe Goliath was from that branch of people, the one who David had slain. But anyway, they brought a bad report that had no faith, that was filled with cowardice, and that had no thought or no proclivity to acknowledge God in their sight or in their thoughts. Verse 14, or chapter 14, though, we come to a different conclusion. We come to a different report. Verse 6, Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh. Now, at this point, Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim. Caleb was from the tribe of Judah. And if you remember your Israelite history, Ephraim was the chief nation of the house of Israel, which ended up being on the north, to the north of Jerusalem. And Judah, Caleb's tribe, were the ones who dwelt at Jerusalem, and they were the Jews. So it's interesting that these two particular folks, Joshua and Caleb, from these two tribes, were the ones who stood up for what was right. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And you probably could have made good money as a tailor in that land, because about every time something bad happens, that's what you read. And they tore their clothes. It's an expression of angst or anxiety, an expression of distress that at people and so forth. So that happened quite a bit. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey, if the Lord delights in us. Only," verse 9, "only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread." Now they had, on the one hand, the other 10 folks, the other 10 spies that said this land devours its inhabitants. But here, Caleb and Joshua are saying, "No, this is a land, they're bread for us. This is nothing. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." And all the congregations said to stone them with stones. They were ready to kill them just for their testimony, just for the suggesting that, "No, let's go do this. We can do this. We can handle these people. It's our land. God has given it to us. We need to go and take it because God is with us." They were standing up to their friends, and while it must not have been easy, they made it look pretty easy. They didn't seem to have much trouble with it. Finally, in this regard, after Moses died, Joshua became the successor to Moses, and we see this at the end of Deuteronomy and the beginning of the book of Joshua. In Deuteronomy, the 34th chapter, it says in verse 9, it says, "Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, so the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Lord had commanded." Now this was at the end of Moses' life. Moses was 120 years old, and he died. God took him and hid him somewhere and buried him. I always found it interesting that Moses, in verse 7, it says he was 120 years old when he died, and his eyes were not dim. nor his natural vigor diminished. He was still a strong, vibrant person, even at 120 years old when God took him. But now it's Joshua's turn. Joshua has been commissioned. In verse 1 of Joshua, just the next page in my Bible, says in verse 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the land, all the people, to the land which I am giving them, the children of Israel. It's your job now. You're in charge, he's telling Joshua. You go and you take the land. And you do, and you continue, because Moses, obviously, and anybody from 40 years old and older that had left Egypt was not going to inherit this land. So it became Joshua's job to carry on and to conquer the land of Canaan, the promised land. In verse 6, he said, be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to your fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Think about it. They had been wandering for 40 years in the wilderness, or in the land on the other side of the Jordan, on the land away from Canaan, between Egypt and Canaan. They'd been wandering for 40 years until everybody, all their fathers and mothers and all those who were 40 years and older, till all of those had died. Or I think it was, I'm sorry, I think I said 40, I believe it was maybe 20 and over, till they had all died. And now it's time to go and take possession of the land. But the land, it sounds easy and looks easy on the page, but the land was full of people. They had settlements. There were people in the land. It wasn't like this land was empty and waiting for them. As the spies had said, this land devours its inhabitants. Joshua, of course, knew that as long as God was with them, they could do it. But it took courage. It took a lot of courage. And he knew that not everybody had courage. A lot of interesting things happened while they were doing that. It took probably, I think they feel, most people feel it was 7 years that it took for them to conquer the land, to rid everybody. And God had said, I'm not going to dispossess these people all at one time, lest the land become full of animals and become wild, and then you'll have an even bigger struggle in getting it. So he wasn't going to let them just go in and poof, they go in and displace everybody like blowing a bunch of dust away. That's not the way it was going to happen. It was going to take effort, and it was going to be step by step. And again, it probably took them about 7 years. So starting at Jericho, they were going to have about 7 years of fighting, 7 years of pushing people out, 7 years of struggle. They had their setbacks. There were times when, for one reason or another, things went wrong. In chapter 7, we won't turn there for lack of time, but in chapter 7, there was the matter of Achan, and he had taken some restricted thing. I'm guessing it was some kind of idols that he had brought in or whatever, things that were forbidden that they weren't supposed to have. So as a result of that, they went out to fight a battle. And guess what? They ended up being pushed back and being killed, and they ended up not winning that battle. They sent, I think, 3,000 men out there and lost probably most of them because of this particular sin. Well, they overcame that eventually when they found out what it was and took care of it. And then there was a little funny incident in chapter 9. We could turn there. Chapter 9, and this was with the Hivites, or Hivites. in chapter 9. They were a group of people, and they came there under the guise of some trickery. What they did in beginning in verse 3, the inhabitants of Gibeon, which were the Hivites, heard that what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, and they worked craftily, and they went and pretended to be ambassadors. They took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals on their feet, and old garments on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy, to make it look like they had come for forever, way off in the distance somewhere. And they went to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal. And they told him, "We have come from a far country. Now, therefore, make a covenant with us." Then the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you dwell among us, so how can we make a covenant with you?" But they said, No, we're your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" They told him, "From a very far country. For we have heard of the Lord God's fame and what he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the kings of the Amorites who were beyond on the other side of the Jordan, and to Sihon and to Og, and all these things. Therefore, our elders and all the inhabitants of our country said, 'Go out there and take provisions with you for the journey, and go meet with them, and say to them, we are your servants,' and so on and so forth. This bread of ours," and they showed him their bread that they had brought, "we took hot for our provision from our houses on the way we departed to come to you. But now look, it's dry and moldy. It's all, dry crusts and inedible and moldy. And wineskins were new, and now look at them. They're torn. And our garments were new and sandals, and now they have become old on the journey." They had them all fooled here. But it wouldn't have had to happen. They made one mistake. Then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord. They could have, and if they would have, God would probably have let them know that this is a trick. And as it was, those people ended up living with them for a long time and being a thorn in the side to them, as were most of those people who they didn't displace completely as they were told to. Finally, in Joshua 18, after many years, after quite a long time of fighting, of chasing the enemy, and of all the things that it would take and that it did take to displace those who were in the land, it says in chapter 18, verse 1, "The whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them." It took a lot of courage, it took a lot of effort, and it took a lot of doing and a lot of time for Joshua to get this accomplished. It wasn't easy, but Joshua got it done. And at the end of the book, it says that, or maybe even the beginning of the next book of Judges, I think, it says that they lived in peace and they lived according to God's laws all the years of Joshua and of those elders who had overlived Joshua as well. So they had a long period there of peace and tranquility after Joshua and his folks, his people, had taken the time or had taken made the effort and had subdued and conquered the land of Canaan. Now let's go to the prisoner of war and take a quick look there and see what happened there. The prisoner of war, you might remember who might have been a prisoner of war, a POW. And that was Daniel. In Daniel, the first chapter, it sets the story up a little bit. We won't go through as much detail here. It's a shorter story, and we know probably this story a little better than we might have the story of Joshua. In Daniel, the first chapter, in the third reign of the year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, we might you know, we probably remember that from some of the descriptions, I believe, in 2 Kings and so forth. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, which was in Babylon, to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. This was the displacement, or the beginning of the displacement, of the southern tribe of Judah, and they're being carried off into the land of Babylon, and Jerusalem being sacked and burned and destroyed. It was the beginning, or in at some phase in that particular process. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles. Now, in 2 Kings, where is that? 2 Kings 10, 18, it talks about, we can read about, this was under the reign of Hezekiah, we can read about the fact that some of Hezekiah's descendants are going to be in the hierarchy, or in the Babylonian captivity. And it was just the fulfillment of that prophecy that was coming to place, which Hezekiah was a good king, but he, at the end of his life, he sort of let down. But he there were other kings that before him and after him that were terrible, very, very bad. And they, for that reason, God left them to be destroyed and carried away. Now he said, get young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, and who had ability to serve in the king's palace. So he wanted the best and the brightest. The King Nebuchadnezzar wanted them brought into the centers for learning, and he wanted to teach them the Babylonian culture, and he wanted to teach them the wisdom and the knowledge of that, of his empire, so that they could be of use to them. In which it was sort of wise and smart of him to do that, because these were bright kids. And I say kids because it doesn't say how old they were. Some people feel they might have been around 16 or something of that nature, but we don't know exactly for sure how old they were. But when they did that, they brought him into this place. He brought him out and away from where they were, and they brought him to a place where they were going to be groomed to be of service to the kingdom. But they, in verse 5, the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank. Now, we probably, Daniel, being Jewish, would have been he would have had a diet that was that would have been in line with the dietary laws of his land. The dietary laws of God, which were clean, the clean and unclean foods. And so at this point, this would have probably included things that were either offered to idols, and maybe there were rituals as they ate and so forth. And also, there would have been unclean foods that would have been included here, very probably, because they didn't have the same dietary guidelines that they followed as the Jews did. But verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. An act of courage for a man as young as Daniel was, a big act of courage, but not his biggest act of courage. But this was, he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, and we probably know the story, that he asked that he could only eat vegetables, and his superior, the one who was overseeing them, told him, "No, I can't do that because I'm afraid of my superiors. I can't do that. I can't let you eat differently from all the other people, so you're going to have the same diet. But Daniel made a deal with him because he had come into favor with this person, and this person liked him. He told him, he says, let's do this. For 10 days, we'll eat vegetables. Then after 10 days, we'll take a look, and we'll see what it looks like, see if we're going backwards, see if we're getting skinny and look ragged and so forth, and then we'll go from there. Then you can do as you wish with us. So that's what they did. He consented with them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. That's in verse 14, and in verse 15 we know what the outcome is. At the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter than all the other ones around them. So they were allowed to continue to do that. But it took courage, took a lot of courage. If you were in a foreign land, in a foreign prison somewhere, and you or in a foreign, in a position like them, it would take a lot of internal fortitude, or intestinal fortitude, as they say, for us, for myself, or probably for yourself, to do what Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, did. Because they took a big risk in doing that. He took a chance in doing that. He didn't know what the outcome was going to be. He thought what the outcome would be in terms of what their appearance would be. He had faith that that's what would happen. But nonetheless, he didn't know if this would be his demise or not. But it wasn't. Now, mostly, when we think of Daniel, probably, we think of the things that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did, that's some of the things. And we also think of his dreams and the interpretation of the dreams that he had and the prophecies that are aligned with the book of Daniel. But that's not all that there was to Daniel, even in the book of Daniel. And I don't know if you have ever gone to the zoo or not. But as you go through the zoo and you look at the wild animals, have you ever looked into the lion's cage? And have you ever thought what would happen if you fell into the lion's cage? Probably wouldn't last very long, I'm guessing, because lions can be very ferocious, especially if they're hungry. Especially if they're hungry. But this is what happened to Daniel. What I think there was even a little children's song or hymn about Daniel and the lion's den, I believe. I remember that. But in chapter 6, and in verse 4, as always happens, and in general, even still today, the Jewish people are envious of them. I think it's because they're successful, they're prosperous. And really, probably the real reason is because they've believed in the true God. Now, obviously today, they don't know the truth, all the truth. They know some of it, but they don't know all of it. But nonetheless, it's always been that Jewish people have been envied, and Jewish people have been criticized, and people have hated them for who they were, what they believed in, and so forth. And it was no different here. The governors, verse 4, and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, because Daniel had been made into a governor himself. He was over much of the kingdom, and they hated that. They were upset about that, and they were looking there. They tried to find fault with him because they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. So what did they do? They devised a plan to sort of trick Nebuchadnezzar and to sort of, I guess it was Darius at this time who was the leader of the kingdom. And they tried to get him, they tricked him, and they tried to get him to take care of Daniel for them. So what they did, they set up this thing where made a commandment or made a decree that nobody could pray to anybody but the king for a certain period of time, because they knew that Daniel prayed to his God every day. Actually, he prayed to them three times a day. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, this decree that they had done, he went home, and in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. He'd always done that. Three times a day he prayed with his windows open toward Jerusalem to his God. They knew that, and that's why they had made the decree. Then they, of course, witnessed this. They went and made sure that they witnessed it. And they went to the king, and they went before the king in verse 12 and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered that the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So the answer said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day to his God, just like he always has. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased, for he knew that he had been set up. He knew what had happened. But he had made the decree, and he had signed and sealed and delivered it, so he knew he couldn't back out either. But he was greatly displeased with himself, verse 14, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. He was trying to find a way that he could deliver Daniel, and he labored till the going down of the sun to do that. And the men approached the king and said, Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. The law of the Medes and Persians was a dictate that you couldn't change. It was hard and fast. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. And we know what happened. The king spoke, saying, Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Sort of a funny thing to say for someone that's throwing you into the den of lions, that I know that he'll save you. He'll deliver you. But then a stone was brought and laid in the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring, and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. It's too late now. And the king went to his palace, and he spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought in. He was genuinely concerned and disturbed about this because he liked Daniel. He was Daniel's friend, I guess if you could say that. Yeah, but Daniel had the courage to stand up and do what was right, no matter what the consequences were. And as the story ends, the next morning he came and took the stone away, and Daniel was still alive. I think maybe he used one of the lions for a pillow, I don't know. But they threw those people who had done this to him. They threw them in there, and they and their families were consumed before they even hit the bottom of the cage. Daniel was a courageous person. And again, does courage come from, are you naturally born with courage, or does it come from somewhere else? Well, courage comes from a number of places. In big moments, though, how do you find the courage to do what is right? And what Daniel did, what Joshua did, and what Private Johnson did. Many factors, conviction, and in the case of Daniel and his friends, God's help. And there are more ways, but I want to focus on the next few minutes, and analyze this just a little bit further and focus on one particular area. They trained for these moments. They trained for what they did. Think about Joshua, for example. He traveled all around for many years, 40 years in the wilderness, along with the rest of them, and he saw what God did for them. That was one thing. But also, he had little bits of training. He had that little skirmish with Amalek, which wasn't a big thing because it wasn't a big group. And they probably had a lot more with them than Amalek had with them. So he got a little bit of training in courage. He got a little bit of training in what to do when things get tough. He had a little bit of training in that. When he went out, when he went with the other 11 folks to spy out the land, and they came back, he had a choice. He could have said, "Yeah, the inhabitants are just too tough for us. Let's just stay here." But he didn't. He got another little bit of training there. He got a little more prepared for the big jobs that take big courage. He ended up saying, "No, with God's help, we can do this." And he stood up to his friends who were ready to stone him and his friend Caleb. They were ready to do away with him. He got another little bit of practice there. And I'm sure there were other occasions and times when he got a chance to practice courage. It took a lot of courage. Probably his biggest moment of courage was to go out into the land of Canaan, a strange and foreign land, and to fight the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, the promised land, to fight with them and to overcome them. It took 7 years, give or take. I'm assuming most of the commentators feel that it was probably around 7 years, based on some of the internal dating that you can find as you go through some of the events. So let's just, for the sake of discussion, say that it was 7 years, but it took that long of fighting, of struggling, of doing without, of being out in the elements to do all this. It was a huge job. And then when he was finished with that, then he had to deal with all the tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel, in placing them where their inheritance was. And while that was not as big of a deal in terms of courage as the fighting was, it still was a big issue and a big job. But he trained for it as he developed. Daniel, the same way. He was brought up in the king's palace back in Jerusalem. It must have been a big blow for him when they came in and everything he knew and was surrounded with was taken from them. And they were put in chains and marched off to Babylon, which was 3 months' journey, I forget, something like that. It was quite a ways from Babylon, or from Jerusalem to Babylon. It was a long way. And they had to do it with people that were hostile towards them. But he had the upbringing and some of the training. And then when he got there, there was it wasn't that small, issue that took courage when he said, "No, I'm not going to defile myself with the king's delicacies. I'm not going to do it. I know it's not right, so I'm going to make whatever it takes to not do it." Another small bit of training that he got and preparation he got for the big thing. When you're faced with being thrown into the lion's den, he didn't hesitate. He went home and prayed as he always did, as he did every day for his whole life. And he didn't hide it. They knew about it, and he let them know that I'm going to continue to do that. Well, he was thrown into the lion's den, and we read the outcome. It was fine. All of these folks had trained in little things before the big things came. You and I are being trained in that very same way. We have little opportunities all the time to have courage, to stand up for what's right, to stand up against wrong. We have the same thing sometimes, and some of the hardest times are when it is with friends. We're with a group of friends who maybe doesn't believe like we do, and it's easy to go along. It takes courage to say, "No, I can't do that. No, it's not right." it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of internal intestinal fortitude for us to do that. But we have to do it. Those little things, we have the same opportunities as they did with those little things to be able to stand up and to be counted, to stand up and say, no, we won't do that because, and we can't do that because it's not right. In Luke, the 16th chapter, we find something that Jesus said. It's not directly related to courage, but it is bearing on it. It's an example of what does happen. Big acts of courage begin with little acts of courage. In the 16th chapter of Luke, in verse 10, Christ said, "He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much." If we don't have the courage to stand up to little things, we won't have the courage to stand up to big things. It's just sort of a fact of life. It's the way life works. It's the way life is. We are going to be tried. In 1 Peter, if you want to turn back there, 1 Peter 4. 1 Peter 4. In verse 12 and 13, it says, Peter writes, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy." We are going to be faced with trials. We are going to be faced with difficulties. We have to use those little moments of trial, little moments of difficulty, and stand up for what is right. We need to use the courage we can muster up through God's help, through the conviction that we have in what's right and what's wrong. We need to stand up, and as we do that, we become more prepared for the bigger things of that take courage. 1 Corinthians 10:13, it says, "We will not be tested beyond what we are able to stand." We will not be tested beyond what we can handle. 10 verse 13, "No temptation has taken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able." As we think about that, and maybe we don't think of it in this way, but we are maybe, through those small areas of encouragement, maybe part of what this means is that we are being strengthened, that we are being prepared for bigger things, that we are being prepared so that when the big things come, we're stronger and can face more than we could now. Courage is not the absence of fear. It is learning to do the right thing in spite of fear. Cowards turn back and don't do that. But those who have courage will face it no matter what the consequences are. Exercise makes us stronger. We can keep that in mind when that thing that causes us to have trouble, when it comes up. I know we don't like to face problems and issues and so forth. But instead of thinking of it as something to drag us down, if we think about it as something that makes us stronger and that makes our courage grow, we can deal with it a lot more readily. James, the first chapter, this is our last scripture. James 1, and verse 2 and verse 3, he says, James says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance." It produces what God wants in us. He is strengthening us so that when the big things come, we will have the courage to do the right thing.